Good afternoon. My name is Paul Bauman. I am the Receiver General of Westminster Abbey. I have a great privilege of occupying an office going back to 1537, which doesn't involve, for any of you who are worried, receivership and the Abbey, but does involve the lay administration of this wonderful place and looking after the 1,000 or so people who work here to make Westminster Abbey the place that it is. One of my other great joys is to be part of the steering group for the Institute, the Westminster Abbey Institute, which runs this series of programmes. It's one of the most interesting parts of the job, and it's a great pleasure, therefore, to be able to welcome you today, both on behalf of the steering group for the Institute and more broadly on behalf of the Dean and Chapter of Westminster Abbey, to this final session of our spring series on the fascinating topic of justice. We've had so far three stimulating lectures by members of the Abbey team in the Lady Chapel. We've had on Tuesday the annual Gore lecture by Professor Michael Banner on the topic of justice and how that relates to a variety of other issues of deprivation, inequality and the like, with a particular reference to the prison system. Today you have the special package of three-in-one entertainment on this topic from the panel that I'll briefly introduce. But if you've missed any of the previous elements of the spring series, and I can heartily recommend all of them, they are all available on the Institute page of the Abbey website as video recordings of those events, and they definitely reward an hour or thereabouts of your time for each of them, should you be interested in catching up. Today we're gathered in this rather fine room. It goes back to the 14th century, but as you may have spotted, it got a little bit of restoration after bomb damage in the war, for this final section, a further reflection on this important topic. In this very room, Henry VII and Abbot Islip, who was one of the major figures in the history of the Abbey, had regular dinner meetings, and I found myself musing slightly what they would have thought about this topic of justice in the slightly uncertain ages that they were living in and what advice they could bring to us in this particular context. You may recall that Henry VII had a rather interesting penchant for using the Star Chamber approach to getting justice done rather more quickly than the justice system of his time was able to deliver. We'll perhaps reflect later as to whether that would be a good approach here. The other person who might have some things to say about justice in both its theology and its practicality is Thomas More, who was imprisoned here until the time when he was transported to the Tower and dealt with in the rather unfortunate way that he was dealt with in his time. So there are plenty of resonances in this room, I think, of justice in its various forms and whether that's been well or badly served. Our three distinguished experts today are able to offer, I hope, a slightly more dispassionate approach to justice than perhaps Thomas More could do if he were still here, but a very well-informed view on this critical topic from the vantage point, respectively, of a former Lord Chief Justice, a QC turned cabinet minister, and an academic specialising in theology, ethics and public service. You have their biographies in front of you, so I wasn't proposing to subject them to a list of all of their many achievements, but you may consult that as we go through, of course. And then Lord Judge, Sir Malcolm Rifkind and Professor Esther Reid will give us each a reflection of their thoughts on this topic before we turn to a broader discussion and, critically, your opportunity to ask questions of a panel who have plenty of thoughts. I won't necessarily offer answers in this particular area, but certainly thoughts on the topic when you get to it. So without more ado, let me invite Lord Judge Igor to kick off the proceedings.
Thank you.
With your thoughts.
I'm rather alarmed to think I'm in the same room as Henry VII was talking to the abbot about the legal system. Henry VII, by an act of parliament called Pro Camera Stellata, introduced Star Chamber into a country which had a common law system. And among other things that the common law prevented was the use of torture. By the time you got to Guy Fawkes' trial before the Star Chamber, it's perfectly obvious when you look at his signature on his confession that he had been tortured most horribly. So it was a very good thing we got rid of the Star Chamber in 1641. And that's nothing to do with anything. I'm now going to be slightly provocative, particularly in the Abbey, and particularly with theologians about, But I want to just draw attention to the book of Genesis, which tells the story of the first occasion when justice was administered. The Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, they were on trial. Do you think their trial was a fair trial? They were convicted. They were sentenced. I'll come to their sentence in a moment. They were convicted before a judge who had made the law that they shouldn't eat from a particular apple tree. He was the only witness to the alleged crime. Nobody else saw it. And then he then summoned them before him and he decided to sit in judgment. I think that any first-year law student would tell you the judge should have recused himself. That might have been the end of the story, mightn't it? Because paradise would have gone on forever. And then we'd all have been enriched. But it didn't happen that way. But then most parents would recognise that that system of justice is exactly what we did, in my case rather a long time ago, with our own children. You told them what they could and couldn't do. You knew perfectly well when they'd done it. And on the basis of the evidence before you, you told them off or dealt with them as you thought appropriate. Nobody thought that that was a miscarriage of justice either. Well, the children did, actually. So maybe Adam and Eve had a point. But then what about the sentence? For heaven's sake, they had committed the crime, but every single one of their progeny, and that includes everybody in this room, all around the world, have suffered all the tribulations that mankind has been exposed to. Starvation, war, horrors unimaginable, for women with an extra particular burden to bear as well. Now, I would ask the first-year law student, was that justice to be sentenced, all of us were, for a crime that we hadn't committed, of which we were innocent? I'm sure that's not a theologian's view of it, but it enables me to make the point that perfect justice is inconsistent with the fall of man. And the fall of man means that we are not infallible. And it also means that wherever we're talking about, that the administration of justice begins a long, long way before you get to court. It belongs to the investigation, belongs to the discussions, it belongs to what the contract meant, doesn't matter which area of law you're looking at, what did go on in the house where the children are said to be at risk. Justice begins a long way earlier with this additional problem. Quite apart from mistakes being made because people are human beings, there are the witnesses who want to bear false witness. It's not an accident that the Ten Commandments, among not murdering and not stealing, has not bearing false witness. It is a wicked, wicked thing to do, and a crime, of course. But there's another point it's easy to overlook. There are people in court who do not want justice to be done. The guilty defendant definitely does not want justice to be done and will do everything he can to obstruct it. The party with absolutely not a feather to fly with, for example in a contract, will try and bamboozle the court to produce the answer to the contract that he or she would like the contract to have said if it had said it. And so, in the justice system, you must not overlook that there's one side, in most criminal cases, that doesn't want justice done. Not always, because sometimes it's the prosecutor who's got the lying witness. So, bear in mind when you're trying to examine perfect justice that not all the ingredients are there. And so we can have philosophical discussions, rather idealistic discussions, about what justice can mean in practice. And then we have to ask ourselves this. Well, on what basis is justice done? The idea that we should have people vested with judicial responsibilities who may sit under a palm tree and sort of, depending on their mood, think, well, today I found for the plaintiff, as they used to be called, seven times, so really, next time, I got a fine for the defendant. I mean, well, so there has to be a system. And this is what I'm really trying to drive at. The system has to be created by society. And therefore you come to the question, which I think matters more than any other, is what sort of system do you want and how shall we have it? We make it. In this country, we make it. In any democratic country, we make it. And then pause. That's wonderful, provided the laws are good, sensible, and reflective of society. Come with me into my experience as a barrister. I was in court the day after the last but one young man was hanged for murder. I've never been in a building so dead, and I knew, was told, that the judge had gone to spend the day at the local church in prayer. I had a client who was convicted. There's no doubt about it. He admitted it. Convicted of consensual buggery with another man. In private, both adults, and my client was sent to prison for 3 years. A young woman, an older woman, but a younger woman for this purpose, who'd been raped, who conceived a child, in medieval times was regarded as undoubtedly having consented. In my lifetime, and some of yours here, that young woman bearing the rapist child could not have a termination of pregnancy. So we need to reflect rather carefully about the laws. You see, the point I'm trying to make is this. In 1960s, most people thought these laws were right. And it was only agitation by more and more people that eventually had them reformed. We decriminalised all these various activities, subject to certain conditions, of course, in relation to abortion. We decriminalised attempting to commit suicide. If you failed to commit suicide, you had committed a crime, and you were sentenced. And we still have a law that says that somebody who assists you to commit the suicide that you wish to commit is committing an offence. I speak with some feeling about this. I've had to deal with the problem. I had to deal with the problem as a judge myself. What was I to do? My own feelings of profound compassion for this couple, in each case, couple. It was a loving relationship. One of them wished to die because of his in one case and her condition in another. The other half of their relationship was willing to help as a final act of love and devotion. What am I to do? Well, I'm afraid I had to have to tell you. I took the view, I maintained that I was right to do it. I had to follow the law, because Parliament has not yet decriminalised helping someone attempting to commit suicide. And so I have direct personal experience of the need for us to understand that the law has to be made not by judges, but by whoever we send, in our case, to Parliament. But then you have to ask another question, and I'll come shortly to an end. So we always say we have to obey the law. The law's been laid down for us here in Parliament, and as members of the society in which we live, we obey the laws. But we need to be careful. Nazi Germany was the product of laws properly enacted. Appalling regime, lifestyle of apartheid in South Africa was entirely lawful. Entirely. So there's a distinction to be drawn, and I know that Malcolm will take this up, between rule by law and rule of law. English is the most remarkable language. Two short two-letter words. I mean, they couldn't be shorter. And yet, there's a profound difference between the two. Rule of law is what we all adhere to. We will need it for the future that is to come. I mean, one day, you will be banned from driving your cars. Not you, I'm sorry to say this, there aren't many of you who say about 12 or 15 here, but It will be undoubtedly proved that cars that are driven by a human being are more dangerous than cars driven by a computer. And eventually, it will be proposed that human beings shouldn't drive. And eventually, there will be a law saying it is a criminal offence to drive a car yourself. You won't be here to see whether I'm right or wrong. Actually, some of you will. But there's a much more serious. We will be creating, Claire heard me on this yesterday, fatherless and motherless children. What laws shall we have? We'll have to wait for Parliament to decide what they will be. In the end, though, the rule of law requires rather more, therefore, than a law-making process. And if I have to identify immediately the characteristics, everybody in this country, whether Prime Minister or poor man sleeping on the streets, should be treated equally by the law. If you treat people equally, you don't have Nazi Germany or apartheid South Africa. There are problems about how we treat people equally. There's the funding issue, but that's the principle that we have to go for. That's the first ingredient. And the second, of course, then, is that the law should be clear and understood, and that when the issues arise about what the law means or what the consequences relating to the law are, you have to go to an independent judiciary. Brexit is giving us awful, awful troubles. But hang on a minute. I think it's wonderful. I mean, there's something about Brexit that is wonderful. Okay. Oh, I don't get a warm reception to that idea. But look, the Prime Minister wished to engage with Article 80 without consulting Parliament. A citizen, with a couple of supporters, took on the whole weight of the government of the United Kingdom and went to court. And in the end, the judges said, "You're right. The government of the United Kingdom is wrong. This is an issue for Parliament." Now, forget the way in which some of the press regarded that decision. What really matters is that that was the end of it. The Prime Minister accepted it. The situation led to her obeying it. The individual citizen was not penalised in any way. Nobody knocked on her door in the darkness of the night. And as to the judges, they remained in post. They've continued in post, those who haven't reached retirement. Nobody suggested that we should change the system for appointing judges. I think that's an amazing thing. I can think of many countries where you couldn't have that complete list of ingredients that I've offered you. So, when we're in this slough of despond about Brexit, perhaps we could remember that there are some things which have held firm through it. And one of them is the rule of law. I've got one more ingredient. It must be done in open court. For a variety of obvious reasons. But the one I want to focus on is this. The judge has to remember that the judge himself or herself is on trial. Every time you sit in judgment, you yourself are on trial. You're on trial about how you behave. You're in trial about what sort of human being you are, and you're on trial to try and get the best answer that the evidence will allow you to give. I think that's very salutary. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. As a mere lawyer following a former Lord Chief Justice, I'm tempted to simply say I concur and then sit down. But I suspect I may not be allowed to get away with that. Igor started by referring to what happened in the Garden of Eden. And I couldn't help recollect the very first time I heard Dr. Kissinger speak in London, back in the 1980s, end of the Cold War, and everything was dramatically changing at that particular moment in time. And he began his speech by saying, follow his accent, but he started by saying, "When Adam and Eve left the Garden of Eden, never to return, As they did leave, Adam turned to Eve and said, "You know, my dear, we are living in an age of transition." I was also struck by the introductory comments of our chair, who reminded us that Henry the VII had actually had lunch or had events in this very, very room. And given that I know you don't want long speeches, I had brought back to me the alleged remark that Henry the VIII made to each of his six wives, you know, when he said, "Don't worry, I do not intend to keep you long." Now, we are today discussing justice. And justice is an idea, it's an ideal, it's a vision, it's a concept. But I'm a mere politician, and I therefore try to look at these issues from the position of trying to assess how do you have practical application of what would otherwise be a wonderful theory, a wonderful concept. But is it just a vision? Is it just an idea that we can argue about as to its precise meaning? But its meaning is only relevant in the context of whether it changes people's lives and makes things happen that wouldn't otherwise happen. So the challenge for society over the years and over the centuries is how to translate justice into a practical means of delivering certain desirable objectives. And we're very familiar with it at the personal level. If we go to court as a plaintiff in a civil action, or indeed if there is an accused person facing criminal justice, then the concept of justice is relatively clear, and a judge or a jury ultimately make that judgment based on very clear legal principles. But I want in my remarks to concentrate on how you apply justice at a different level, at the level of a whole society, of a state, where there is a relationship between the government and its citizens. And when you are dealing with justice in that context, then we have a very real question, as Igor himself commented on, of the use of language which can sometimes accurately describe what happens or can sometimes be used to try to mislead. And when we're talking about the rule of law, this is exactly the territory I want to dwell on. Because there isn't a government, there isn't a state anywhere in the world whose government does not have a legal system, that does not seek to use that legal system in what it would describe as being the application of legal principles and in the pursuit of justice. But we know the reality, of course, is extremely different as you go from country to country and from political system to political system. And I want to share with you a particular conversation I had when I was Foreign Secretary in 1996-97. And one of my responsibilities was the very final stages of the negotiations with China over the transfer of Hong Kong to China. And as part of that, most of the work had been done by my predecessors, but I had to have several meetings with the then Chinese Foreign Minister, Chen Qichen. Some in Europe, but this particular meeting was in Beijing. And I didn't go directly to Beijing, I went through Hong Kong, met local people in Hong Kong, and they tried to impose upon me the view, not impose is the wrong word, to persuade me of the view, that when I saw the Chinese minister, they said, "Will you please make it clear to him that when we become again part of China under two systems in one country, when we talk about two systems, preserving some of our normal way of life, yes, we attach importance to having more than one candidate to vote for in an election, but equally important will be what they call the rule of law," which in Hong Kong they were used to. They had independent judges, they had an independent judiciary, and all the other freedoms that we associate with that concept. So I get to Beijing and I meet the Chinese foreign minister and I put these points to him. And I've never forgotten his reply. He said, "Mr. Rifkin, you do not need to worry. We in China, we too believe in the rule of law. In China," he said, "in China, the people must obey the law." And I said, "Now hold on, minister. When I'm talking about the rule of law, it's not just the people who must obey the law, it's the government must be under the law. There must be independent judges to whom the governments will pay respect if they are told they are breaking the law." You know, not only didn't he agree with me, he hadn't the faintest idea what I was talking about. the concept itself was so alien to this, the values of his party, of his society, or whatever. And in a sense, it's a bit like Vladimir Putin in Russia as well, I'm afraid, and a number of other people. As we've already agreed, it's not just rule of law, it's rule by law. In such systems, those in power do respect the law. They use the law as a way of perpetuating their own power. And by criminalizing the activities of those who seek to oppose them, however peaceful that opposition might be, they hope to preserve their own privileges and their own power. So this is a very, very serious matter. And it's one that should not be given the title of justice, because in fact it is the perpetuation of grave injustice by any normal use of language. Okay, now that's sufficient that I want to say when it's relatively clear, because without going into all the examples, there are some countries that are obviously dictatorships, whether it's North Korea or China or wherever, and there are others that are democracies, and there are some in between. But I want to take it one stage further, because there is also an issue of the extent to which justice either exists or can be threatened within countries that we would all recognize as democracies, using that term in a proper sense. And this has become much more relevant in the last 2 or 3 years, because we have seen a serious debate now, in a very healthy way, being pursued as to whether all the freedoms, not just in this country, but in other countries, particularly after 1989 and the end of the Cold War, when it looked as if the world was entering a new phase of global freedom, global democracy, global values of a common kind. Mr. Fukuyama described it as the end of history. I remember when he said that, I couldn't help thinking of an alternative phrase: as one door closes, another often slams in your face. Sometimes the vacuum that is created by solving one problem, the disappearance of Soviet communism, can allow other injustices like ethnic hostilities and racialism and nationalism and so forth of an extreme kind to take its place. So where have we gone wrong in this particular one? Because it's all very relevant to the question of justice. I think the simplest way I would describe it is that we talked about the triumph of liberal democracy. That was the phrase that we used. And we allowed ourselves to believe that liberal democracy was a single concept, that you either had it or you didn't have it. But the reality is actually there are quite separate components. There is democracy and there is our liberal values. They very often combine, but not necessarily. I mentioned Hong Kong a few moments ago. When Hong Kong was a British colony, it had liberal values, it didn't have democracy. It was a colony, it had no self-government at all. It doesn't have it now in any fundamental sense. But the liberal values were there. But what's interesting is it can also be the other way around, as we are now realizing. You could have countries that are, by any normal set of criteria, countries that have democratic governments properly elected, either in whole or sufficiently, by their electorate in free elections. Think of Mr. Erdogan in Turkey, Mr. Orban in Hungary, Mr. Bolsonaro, the new president of Brazil, and other examples I could think of. All three, there may have been flaws in the electoral process, but no one seriously doubts they won a plurality of the votes. They are president because they met the democratic standard. But in each of these cases, and in other countries of that kind, there has been a clear erosion of liberal values, and the fear is how far that might be allowed to go. So it's a much more complex and sophisticated issue. So let me conclude my remarks by bringing it back to the concept of justice. How does that fit in to what I'm saying? I think it comes down ultimately to what we mean by liberal values in political terms. I'm talking about it from a political context, although it obviously has ethical aspects that must govern it. I think when we're talking about liberal values in a society, we go beyond the question of the right to vote and choose a government. And I'll just give three main examples of what I think the components need to be. There may be others, there will be others, but these are the ones I wish to share with you. First of all, it is the willingness to accept the legitimacy of opposition to the government of the day. That opposition is not something that can be remotely contemplated as criminal, unless, of course, it turns to violence. And this country has an extraordinary record, not a perfect one, but an extraordinary record. When you think about it, for, I think, 200 years, we have had people called Her Majesty's Loyal Opposition. That's not a 20th century phrase. That goes back, I think, to the 18th century. And when you think about it, it's inherently absurd. How can Her Majesty have a loyal opposition whose function is to get rid of Her Majesty's government whenever they can and however they can, albeit peacefully? And yet it was recognized then, and it's been recognized ever since, that if you want to respect the right of opposition in a democratic society, then it must have equal legitimacy to that of government. It doesn't have equal power, for obvious reasons, but it must have equal legitimacy. And we're not the only country that respects that. Of course we're not. But it's extraordinary, the language we have used, Her Majesty's opposition, loyal opposition, to explain our beliefs. And linked to that is that there must not just be a respect for opposition, there must be a respect for the rights of minorities, political minorities, but also other kinds of minorities in a society. We're all aware of the controversy of how an elected government can reconcile the mandate it's been given, perhaps only by 51% of the population in an election or in a referendum, dare I say it, with the rights of the minority, who are also to be measured in millions of people, with views and opinions of their own. There's no simple answer to that. But clearly, justice, if it's to be seen as a term relevant to that kind of question, has to involve, at the crudest level, a government that has a majority, like Mr. Orban in Hungary or Mr. Erdogan in Turkey, cannot simply ignore the minority and expect to be respected notwithstanding. But even if such crudities don't exist in a society, there is nevertheless a challenge for both government and opposition, for those who supported them and those who opposed them, to identify where it is possible to at least meet some of the aspirations of those whose views cannot prevail because they are the minority after a democratic election. And the final example I use is that justice also has to ensure that power is not concentrated in central government. The concept of civic society we take for granted, by which I mean not just NGOs, but I mean the millions of voluntary organizations, local authorities, but also voluntary coming together of communities, each with power or at least influence in their own community, where that is taken for granted. And we take it for granted. But I remember speaking to Russians who had lived and been brought up during the Soviet period. And that was the one thing they just had no experience of. The party that controlled their state controlled their way of life as well, told them what they had to, just not the political allegiance they had to have, but what they must think, what they must do, how they must organize their lives. The most obvious extreme example is North Korea, but it exists in many other dictatorships. So I simply conclude my comments by saying that when we are talking about justice, yes, of course, it's an ethical issue. Yes, it's a religious issue. Yes, it's a social issue. But it also goes to the very heart of the political choices that have to be taken in any society. Thank you very much.
Receiver General, ladies and gentlemen, it's a very great pleasure to be here today. Thank you. Pontius Pilate poses to Jesus the truth question: what is truth? If Pilate were with us today, he might well ask the justice question: what is justice? My intention today is not to stage a bare-knuckle fight between the various theories of justice that might be proffered, though that could be fun, it could be interesting, but to speak rather to the persistent witness of Christian tradition that justice is One, the enactment of judgment against injustice. That it is two, the enactment of judgment between guilt and innocence. And that it is three, if it is to reflect anything of the ways of God, then it is tempered with mercy and oriented toward life. So justice is more verb than noun. Our task today is much more usefully related to doing than it is to defining. So the closest that you'll get to a definition of justice from me today is that justice is the enactment of judgment. The point being that what matters more for our purposes than defining justice is how the enactment of justice is conducted, how justice is acted out, made real, practiced in our courts and elsewhere. What then should guide those who frame, interpret, and apply our laws? How might we draw on the philosophy, on Christian teaching, on the wisdom of the apostles and the prophets with respect to the meaning of justice as enacted in practice? Pontius Pilate lost his way. A possible reading of those passages in the Gospels of Matthew and John that recount Jesus' trial suggests that Pilate tried various theories or approaches to justice that we might still recognise today. He tries an appeal to cultural relativism in order to evade responsibility. He weighs possible outcomes in a quasi-utilitarian calculus. He appeals to an a priori principle of equality, whereby the punishment applied to an offender ought to match their crime. And none of these approaches of itself is adequate. Pilate looks into the face of Christ Jesus and still presides over the greatest travesty of injustice in human history. So I've structured my few minutes as a reflection on Pontius Pilate because I suggest he is still very apt for us today. Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law. John 18:31. He plays the cultural relativism card. If it is just in your culture to decide that this man is guilty, so be it. Roman justice has different priorities. As the fifth prefect of the imperial Roman province of Judea, he is tasked with overseeing the exercise of justice. But is this then a weak, indecisive leader who recognises Jesus' innocence but can't find a way to save him from execution? Is it a strong leader who respects cultural diversity and accepts that values are largely a matter of personal or societal taste and decides bravely that he cannot adjudicate between contested views? How deep does your relativism go? Deep enough to allow for variation in traffic laws? Yes. Deep enough to allow for a guilty judgment of an innocent person? Probably no. Today, as for Pilate, there is a path to be walked between an appreciation of cultural diversity and allowing appeals to cultural relativity to become evasions of justice. Then he released for them Barabbas. They had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when they had gathered, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called the Christ?" And all the people answered, "His blood be on us and on our children." And then he released for them Barabbas, Matthew 27:16. If Pontius Pilate was a utilitarian reasoner, he wasn't a very good one. But he calculates the likely outcome. He wants peace in the province of Judea and opts for general social utility of some kind. Releasing Jesus would probably result in more unrest, more violence, more legal wranglings than sacrificing his life for a greater good. Those who approach the "what is justice" question in utilitarian fashion operate in a tradition with connections back to John Stuart Mill and his considerations of what maximises welfare overall. Mill has a chapter in his famous book, Utilitarianism, entitled On the Connection Between Justice and Utility, Is justice, asks Mill, a feeling bestowed on us by nature? No. Is it a particular instinct? No. Is it a revelation of some objective reality? No. Is it something intrinsic to a given action distinct from all other qualities? No. Justice belongs, says Mill, to the order of general expediency. Justice is a means of achieving a particular end that has more to do with process than principle. Justice is a particular kind or branch of general utility. There are no general principles or rights of justice for Mill because justice is a social instrument for maximising welfare overall. If Pontius Pilate were a utilitarian reasoner, he was an act utilitarian rather than a rule utilitarian. Act utilitarians act only on the immediate decision in front of them and whether it will maximise welfare. Rule utilitarians see beyond the immediate decision to the longer-term societal context that needs rules and laws for the maximisation of welfare. In the longer term, executing an innocent person might not make for public peace. Yet Pilate delivered Jesus to be crucified. Today, as for Pilate, the temptation to make short-term decisions at the expense of longer-term considerations can be overpowering. Pontius Pilate performed better as a deontological reasoner. Like the modern philosopher Immanuel Kant, he assumed an a priori principle of equality, whereby the punishment applied to the offender ought to match their crime. Pilate recognised his duty to act in conformity to this principle. Why? What evil has he done? Matthew 27. Pilate shouts to the crowd, "I find no guilt in him." Pilate knew that Jesus was innocent. Assuming the jus talionis, the principle of retributive justice, whereby a person who has injured another is to be punished to the same degree, eye for an eye, Pilate hesitated because he knew that his decision would violate a right known a priori to everyone's reason. His wife might have done better. His wife sent word, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man. I have suffered much because of him today in a dream." But let's keep questions about sex, gender, and law for another day. Having thus exhausted all the approaches available to him, Pilate decides, and justice is enacted simply as his decision. Justice is reduced to the decision of the lawgiver. Standalone answers from legal positivism to the "what is justice" question are rarely adequate. Justice is more than simply administration of the law. Of course, Pontius Pilate did not have available to him the common law tradition of England and Wales. He did not have this evolving body of law that, based on countless decisions, a narrative tradition that is historically extended, to borrow Alistair MacIntyre's phrase, a tradition-specific mode of reasoning, socially embedded in the life of the nation. Of itself, the common law tradition, even in England and Wales, is not an answer to the "what is justice" question, but this tradition contains many resources and is a dynamic place, so to speak, wherein the meaning of justice is negotiated day by day. Within this tradition, the practice of judgment, deciding between guilt and innocence, gives at least partial meaning to the justice question. Justice is the enactment of judgment between guilt and innocence, interpreted over the decades, for which every citizen bears some responsibility. Pilate failed in his exercise of authority with respect to the meaning of justice. Our judges typically do better. Hindsight allows us to see Pilate's failure. Is hindsight enough to keep the narrative tradition that is our common law critically self-aware? How critically self-aware, how societally aware are we with respect to the meaning of justice as enacted every day? One of my favourite Ralph Hagen cartoons is of the United Nations General Assembly. Two legal-looking figures are standing before the presiding chair. Rock beats scissors, sanctions it is. justice is the outcome of a rock, paper, scissors hand game. While rock, paper, scissors might seem a simple playground game, it's become the basis of many mathematical algorithms to assist with decision making. In the UK, the Law Society has recently held public sessions where commissioners took evidence from experts on the topic of algorithms in the justice system. Where algorithm-based AI and machine learning is being used, what controls might be needed? Could, should machine-processed mass data advise or perhaps even decide for magistrates and judges? Will the meaning of justice be given by artificial intelligence? Is the critical self-awareness that we need with respect to the justice question to come from cleverly programmed algorithms? We might be a long way from robots functioning as judges, but questions about the use of AI and how they bear upon the practicalities of the meaning of justice are with us already. Orthodox iconography of Jesus standing before Pontius Pilate shows Jesus standing, thus physically above the seated Pilate. Jesus wears a halo. There is a law higher than either the religious or the imperial law that condemned Jesus to death. This is why, to my mind, theology can be exercised as ideology critique. Philosopher Judith Sklar observed that the rule of law indeed often serves as enforcement mechanism within a particular ideology. In Christian tradition, true justice lies beyond human law. This is why there is an obligation upon the churches and, I venture, upon all those engaged in public service of all faiths and none to provoke disquiet about overconfidence in human law as justice while simultaneously striving for renewed engagement with the wisdom of the prophets and the apostles, with the grammar of the natural law. The challenge every day is to ensure that the enactment of justice is against injustice between guilt and innocence. The icon shows Pilate looking away from Jesus, not encountering him face to face. In Christian tradition, it's a baseline ethical conviction that the face of Jesus is encountered in every perpetrator of a crime, every victim of a crime, every lawmaker, every judge, every solicitor, every migrant, every asylum seeker, and so on. Jesus' humanity is the reason why the churches are under obligation to press always for a justice of a kind that reflects and recognises the humanity of everyone involved in a case, and for attention to the humanity of the supporting institutions, prisons, probation, benefit system, and so on. Icons are packed with symbolism. Even the colours are important. Blue represents earthly life. Jesus' cloak of blue, which covers the majestic purple of his undergarment compared with the earthly terracotta of Pilate's garb, indicates that all here is transient and perishable. A colour never used in Orthodox iconography is grey. Grey represents vagueness, emptiness, and non-existence, and has no place in the icon. Even as we feel that human justice is an impossible demand that is demanded nonetheless, Christian witness is against the greyness that tolerates anything other than justice as the enactment of judgment against injustice, as judgment between guilt and innocence, and as justice tempered with mercy and oriented towards life.
So thank you to all three of our speakers for their contributions today. We're going to move straight into questions. I'm not going to even think about trying to summarise what we've just heard, but I'm sure you will all have taken out of it your own particular learnings. I can't quite resist the temptation to say there's also a lecture on artificial intelligence, which we had in the previous series on the website of the Institute, should you be interested in that aspect, though I don't think we talked about artificial judges in that particular context. Anyway, what we will do for the next 20 minutes or so is to pick up probably a couple of questions at a time, please, from you. It would be enormously helpful if you could say who you are before you pose your question. And second, it would be really helpful if you could make sure it is a question and a reasonably concise question as opposed to a lecture of your own. That would be very helpful. And I'll take one from Francis, if I may, in the front, and then I'll come to the gentleman in the green top to complement it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm a very, very rich, rich conversation. I wonder whether I could ask the speakers how they would categorize the following. In Rwanda, after the 1994 genocide, the prisons were overflowing with people who were awaiting trial, and the court simply couldn't deal with it. And one of the ways in which the government decided to deal with it was to set up the so-called people's tribunals, or Gacaca courts, whereby people in local communities, many of whom had either been victims of injury or indeed had family members who'd been killed by the person they were trying, they tried that person and dealt out local justice. One of the arguments for these kind of Gacaca courts was that it helped that individual to be reintegrated in the community eventually. The purists, the legal people, were absolutely aghast that, you know, we were going back to a medieval system of people's tribunals. I wonder, in view of what the speakers have said, how they would categorise that.
Thank you. May I just pick up, before anyone comes to that question, the gentleman there, please.
My name's Alan Taylor. I'm a retired precision engineer. I've come with a prepared question, fearing I might not accurately recall my question, so I'm just going to read it, if you just bear with me. It's based on a Plato dialogue, The Laws. So I'm just going to read a short sentence and pose my question. So this is Plato. He says, societies will never obtain the worldly prosperity they crave unless they acquire wisdom and justice, and I would add reason. So my question is sustained national prosperity the lawful outcome of the acquisition and application of wisdom, justice, and reason, rather than the application of political and economic ideologies?
Thank you very much. Two nicely contrasting questions, which we'll invite the panel to comment on. Marco, might I come to you first, perhaps, on the first of those questions?
Yes, on the question about Rwanda. I mean, obviously, the concern, if you have people's courts and in the immediate aftermath of slaughter on the scale that we saw in Rwanda, is one, there is always the huge probability, not just risk, that the people who are convicted can be convicted on very little evidence, and sometimes it's almost an emotional spasm of response. That's not just peculiar to Rwanda. It's worth remembering a lot of anecdotes, true, and not just stories, but true hard evidence of what happened in various countries in occupied Europe in 1945 after liberation, when a lot of revenge was carried out, either on Germans or on collaborators, or perceived collaborators. And the standards of proof were pretty minimal in many of these cases. So I'm afraid it's probably an inescapable phenomenon that in the immediate aftermath of a traumatic experience, which Rwanda obviously was, but other countries have also experienced in various ways, justice is expressed in a collective sense, rather than justice which can be combined with a very high standard of proof beyond reasonable doubt for each individual who is before a tribunal.
Well, let me just stimulate you before you all fall asleep. We have people's courts here, don't we? Well, I don't really mean that, but I do mean that our system depends in criminal justice, of serious criminal justice, depends on a jury system. And I personally think it's an admirable system to have 12 members of the public engaged in the question whether guilt has been proved or not. These are just 12 people. They could be any one of you tomorrow. Some of you may well have served on juries. And there is quite a lot to be said for the administration of justice and the eventual imprisonment of an individual for a long time to involve the citizen rather than the professional judge. The professional judge makes sure that the rules of evidence are obeyed. He directs the jury. She tells them what they can take into account and what they can't. But as to whether or not the prosecution has proved guilt, the jury has the final say. And what is more, the judge cannot interfere. If the evidence is proved absolutely beyond doubt that the man is or woman is guilty, the judge still can't say to the jury, this individual is guilty. So in that sense, we have people's courts. And I love the idea that the population of this country is involved in the administration of justice. It is their justice. It is our justice. It's not the judge's justice, and it's not Parliament's justice. That said, I think there are great dangers with people's courts, which are, as Malcolm's really indicated, you're more likely to have injustice. If you had a people's court with professional judges to help them to their conclusion, say, well, that's totally irrelevant. You know, the fact that he played football for Manchester United, you can't take that against him, or Manchester City, if it's in Manchester. Or in my case, if he played for Leicester City, he was undoubtedly innocent. I mean, so you've got to have some. But let's be, Baroness Souza, the problem is, at the end of a war, of a most terrible civil war, the best anybody can do is the best they can do. And I wouldn't be critical of them. But as I say, I think we do have to be just a little careful not to assume that people's courts as such are unacceptable, because we have them.
Thank you very much. Esther, feel free to comment on that question if you wish, but otherwise I wonder if you could take us into the question of the link between judgment and justice and many of the things you were talking about and prosperity of a society which was raised. You must have done lots and lots of thinking and research about this. So what, is there a link between the two, and is it a, how direct is that?
Thank you. Yes, I mean, this first question, I don't really know enough about Rwanda to comment specifically there, but the and my esteemed colleagues have pointed to the difficulties, the risks attaching, but the hope of keeping justice meaningful to a local community, and for, I think you used the phrase, reintegration with a local community, is surely something that is an ambition for our own country. I teach a course called Theology and Criminal Justice, and we start with a contrast between our own system and the American system, which has the death penalty. And I find that there is a visceral reaction amongst many of the students to that system. And when you push that, I think it is because they do not see hope there. It's a lack of redemption. And so the test for me of the UK criminal justice system in many respects is it redemptive in some way? Is there a hope for a restoration to life in some way? That's not to dissipate the need for punishment and retributive justice in its rightful form. But I like that question. And keeping it close, restorative justice, there's a nice practice there sometimes, which is a very helpful process that we employ. But the prosperity question, oh my goodness. You've rather posed it as an either or. So I think all I want to say at this point is that I would dispute the either-or framing. I would hope that it's not a choice between seeking wisdom and seeking prosperity, if I understood you correctly. I'm going to pass it to my colleagues at this point.
Malcolm,
I wanted to add another point on the first question. Because we've both, Igor and I, have emphasised how people's justice at the end of a war can be very random sometimes in its application. But if you think back to 1945, one of the most impressive things was the Nuremberg tribunals. Because not only because they required and received, as it were, they applied normal criminal procedure, criminal rules, before which a defendant could not be, without which a defendant couldn't be convicted, but they actually acquitted one or two people, who undoubtedly were parts of the Nazi regime at a very, very senior level, but they were satisfied that the normal judicial requirements could not be met in these particular cases. And that was very impressive in its own way. And we see that occasionally now with international criminal courts. For example, on former Yugoslavia, some of the people accused of war crimes in relation to Srebrenica or elsewhere. People have been convicted and given very long sentences, but there have been one or two examples where they have either been acquitted of all or some of the charges. So even at times of great emotion, fortunately, we are developing a system that can accommodate that.
Did you want to attempt an answer to the second question?
The second question about national prosperity, I mean, there's two quite separate issues here. Everyone, I think, would agree that the pursuit of national prosperity is a desirable objective. Where the controversy and questions of justice come into it is whether it is done in such a way that the population as a whole benefit from that increased prosperity, or whether large numbers of people either don't or disproportionately don't. And what makes it much more complicated is that our society has increasingly concluded that, at least for this period in our history, capitalism of some kind is the way you create maximum prosperity. But capitalism, by its very nature, is also like going to produce, even if it produces rewards for everyone, it produces far more rewards for those most associated with the wealth creation. So you're not eliminating the controversy, even if the prosperity is there, and even if, to some degree at least, it is being distributed to the community as a whole.
I spent 2 years studying the history of political thought, and I spent a year and a half trying to understand Plato, and I'm really sorry, I never did. But I think that the concepts that you have drawn to our attention may be mutually exclusive, but they may be mutually supportive. I think it depends how you balance the different elements that you've drawn to our attention.
Yes, there's an interesting thing in this, of course, because the dichotomy was between application of justice and fairness and judgment, etc., and political process. I'm imagining that some of you might think there is a possibility for the political process to encompass justice and judgment and fairness, so the opposition may be slightly false in any case. Shall I pick up two more questions, if I may? The lady here in the front, perhaps, and then I'll come to the gentleman at the back.
Thank you. My name is Sheila Page. Actually, it's following up on your question about process, because I wanted to ask you to talk about how you include values, as Sir Malcolm was talking about, in the process of changing laws. I mean, the ones which Lord Judge mentioned were all changes which probably most of us in this room welcomed: end of capital punishment, changes on abortion and homosexuality. But laws don't always change in directions which A, all of us would welcome, or B, would be in accordance with values. Does one need to introduce grit in the system to slow things down, or procedures for somehow including the values which are more permanent? I mean, it's really a question of the desirability of change and the desirability of avoiding reckless change.
Okay, thank you. We'll just pick up the other question and then we'll come to that one.
Peter Haddock, the Diocese of Southwark. The question I want to ask is around one theme connected with justice in the Old Testament is vindication. Another might be idolatry or fidelity, but the one I wanted to ask is vindication. Partly because I have a background in a certain government department, I did notice that by the early 90s there was a shift towards the victim, that there was a pushback in legal commentary at the time around that. I just wondered whether or not, if vindication is a valuable avenue to explore in the concept of justice, whether the common law is the proper place for that rather than legislation. I mean, former Lord Chief Justice is here. I'm thinking of one of his predecessors would be Lord Chief Justice Mansfield, for example, one of his most many famous judgments, but one of which, of course, was to declare that it was not possible to own a slave in England. I think that was one of his most famous judgments.
Thank you. Two fascinating questions. Who would like to begin first, then, with the values in changing laws and how to ensure they're soundly based? That was very much central to your discussion.
I think we have to be very careful. Your values and mine may not be the same. I'm sure our values are, but the way in which they manifest themselves in our attitudes to different forms of conduct and whether they should be criminalised or decriminalised may be different. I gave the examples that I did when I spoke because there was a remarkable period in the 1970s when Roy Jenkins was Home Secretary and sort of right at the inner heart of our political system, when there was a huge liberalisation with laws which I personally strongly agree with. If I may say so to Esther, my worry about capital punishment is that we can get it wrong, and therefore we shouldn't hang anybody, whatever they are convicted of having done. Values, though, are very difficult. What will our values be 50 years from now? I'm absolutely certain that, for example, the way in which we nowadays, having changed hugely the way in which we treat the evidence of children, and we have changed it quite dramatically. My predecessors would not recognise the way we do it, and we think for the best. But 25 years from now, I have no doubt room like this, we say, is that really how they did it? And so values move, standards move. So you've got to go back to a very clear understanding of what the law is, and you have to reform the law where it does not coincide with societal views about the law. And then sometimes you have to stand firm against, for example, the reintroduction of capital punishment. But that's what a free society it is. It involves different people having different views, expressing them, and eventually that coming to pass. May I just deal with the vindication?
By all means.
That's a very serious question, and it's an issue which troubles me. I think the sentencing provisions, the way in which we approach sentencing, has to include, it's not terribly fashionable now, but has to include the danger of treating the defendant in such a way that the victim of his or her crime feels as though we're not understanding the impact of that crime. In other words, we're diminishing what has happened to the victim in a way which the victim deeply resents. For example, I mean, you steal somebody's photographs. Okay, well, a few photographs. But if it's an old lady whose photographs include her wedding photograph with her husband way back in the 1950s, and he's died, and that's all that's left of him, that's a terrible crime. And so you've got to balance all this when you're considering sentence.
So far as values, which is what I'd like to comment on, I think what we'd all like to believe is that values don't change, the values themselves. They're eternal, they're basically principles with which the human race can be associated forever. How they are understood and how they are applied has to just change dramatically as society itself changes. And let me just give one example of what I'm talking about. The attitude towards slavery in the United States and in other countries back in the 18th century. Think of the American Declaration of Independence, always quoted as being the wonderful language used by Jefferson and by others to applaud human liberty and human freedom, written by people, most of whom were themselves slave owners. And, you know, by our standards today, they must have been the most ghastly hypocrites. You know, how could they possibly use the language of the American Declaration of Independence about all people being born free and all this sort of thing, at the same time as they themselves, not just they lived in a society that had slaves, but they themselves had them. They didn't think of themselves as hypocrites. Was that because they were naive, or was it because the values of the day allowed them just naturally to think otherwise? So the only other comment I would make is the one thing I do get irritated by is the demands that are often made, and sometimes governments and others succumb to them, that people today should apologize for what happened 100 or 200 or 300 years ago. The president of Mexico has just written to the Spanish king asking for an apology for what the conquistadores did to the Aztecs when they first arrived in Mexico. Now, it's not only ludicrous, it's positively unjust, using the term we're using today, because nobody around today could remotely be held to be responsible, and yet governments sometimes are under such pressure. I think we've done it ourselves. I think our own government has apologized for some matters of 100, 200 years ago because it felt it was easier just to say the words than to argue it from a point of principle. But I really think we should actually come to grips with this kind of concept, and without in any way softening our scathing criticism of what happened, we shouldn't expect governments of any political colour to be responsible for them today.
Thank you. Yeah, the values question, what do we do with cultural diversity? I think one of the most interesting developments in the philosophical scene recently has been a movement called discourse ethics, associated with people like Jürgen Habermas of the Frankfurt School in Germany. And it's kind of what it says on the tin, it's discourse ethics. So the emphasis is on procedure, the emphasis is on ensuring that everybody is around the table, that everybody's voice is heard around the table, so to speak, whatever that means in practical terms. The risk associated with that, and so everybody has a chance to talk about their values, their particular traditions, etc. The risk, of course, with that is that one associates a right decision with consensus, and consensus doesn't always yield what we might deem to be a right decision. To my mind, consensus, and I think for Thomas Hooker, Anglican divine, consensus is a mark of a good decision. It's not always constitutive of a good decision, and so there might need to be, again, for my purpose, the role of theology as ideology critique. We appeal to the glory of God's laws, the transcendent reference point, which means that you've got then embodied in that dialogue process a reference that is beyond the mere process of discourse. But it's a really, really important mechanism that I think we can learn from, very practically speaking. The vindication question, I don't know where that came from. Am I looking at the wrong people? Sorry. Big questions about the purpose of law. I heed everything that the Lord Judge has said about importance of the victim in the process, but what is the purpose of law? Purpose of law is for the restraint and overcoming of wrongdoing. It's sometimes for the effecting of retributive justice, and there is also an educative purpose in the law. There is a societally educative purpose in the law that might speak to that vindication question. So we just need to keep asking that question.
Could I just add one small point? When I said earlier that I rebuked the idea of apologising for the misdeeds of previous generations, I want to be absolutely clear. I have the strongest empathy with the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, for example, in South Africa, or similar attempts in Ireland to bring together those who committed various sins or crimes or injustices. That's different. There we're dealing with the individuals who were personally involved, either directly or in positions of responsibility in their societies. And there is something very healthy, and it's a healthy form of building a new society, to have some element of apology in such a situation.
Thank you. I'm very, very tempted to allow this to run on for another hour because it is a fascinating and really rich dialogue, and I'm sure there are many aspects we could explore. I'm going to have to draw it to a close because I did promise to finish at 2 o'clock. So thank you, first of all, to our three speakers today who've brought real richness of thought and clear personal value to the discussion, and that's made it, I think, all the more impactful for all of us. Thank you to the audience, because all of these events are brought alive really by the way in which the audience interacts with our wonderful speakers. Thank you to the Institute team as well, both for today, which has been, as always, a triumph of organisation over anyone's attempts to cause chaos, and for the whole series, which I have to say has been an uplifting thing for all of us. So that's really all my thanks for this afternoon. I look forward to seeing many of you, I'm sure, in the autumn series that we have, which explores a topic very close to my heart, at least, which is the arts and their relationship with public service and public values. So I hope that many of you will find it worthwhile to come back in the latter part of this year. It'll all be on the website to explore yet another facet of our society. Thank you all very much indeed, and a good afternoon.